If Western reports were true, he didn't really believe them either, the campaign in Germany was a bloody mess. Until that was over, he was vulnerable. Would NATO try to invade? His operations officer said it was impossible unless the Americans were able to destroy the long-range bombers flying out of Kirovsk first. And the whole point of seizing Iceland had been to prevent the American carriers from moving to a position from which they could do just that. On paper, then, the general expected only increased air attacks, and he had surface-to-air missiles to defend against those. But he hadn't become a divisional commander by merely shuffling papers. North Atlantic. What the hell happened? The captain looked up to see a tube stuck in his arm. The last thing he remembered was being on the bridge halfway through the afternoon watch. Now the porthole on the starboard side of his stateroom was covered. Darkened ship. It was night outside. "You passed out, Captain," the chief hospital corpsman said. "Don't..." The captain tried to rise. His head made it about 18 inches off the pillow when his strength gave way. "You have to rest. You've got internal bleeding, Skipper. You threw up blood last night. I think it's a perforated ulcer. You scared the hell out of me last night. Why didn't you come see me?" The chief held up a bottle of Maalox tablets. "People gotta be so damned smart about everything. Your blood pressure's down 20 points, and you darn near went into shock on me. This ain't no bellyache you got, Captain. You might have to have surgery. There's a helo on the way out now to medevac you to the beach." "I can't leave the ship. I..." "Doc's orders, Captain. If you die on me, I lose my perfect record." "I'm sorry, sir, but unless you get real medical attention real quick, you could be in real trouble. You're heading for the beach." Chapter 32. New Names, New Faces. Norfolk, Virginia. "Good morning, Ed." Commander, Naval Surface Forces, U.S. Atlantic Fleet, was seated behind a desk covered with dispatches that seemed to be organized into piles. "Morning. Half an hour after midnight." Morris hadn't left Norfolk since arriving at dawn on the previous day. If he went home, he'd have to sleep again.
"Morning, sir."
"What can I do for you?" Morris didn't want to sit down. "You want to go back out?" Comnav Surflant asked bluntly.
"Who with?"
"Reuben James's skipper came down with a bleeding ulcer. They flew him in this morning. She arrives in another hour with the fibs from Pack Fleet. I'm assigning her to convoy duty. We have a big one assembling in New York Harbor. 80 ships, all big, all fast, loaded with heavy equipment for Germany. It sails in 4 days with a heavy U.S.-UK escort plus carrier support. Reuben James will be in port long enough to refuel and reprovision. She sails for New York this evening in company with HMS Battle Axe. If you're up to it, I want you to take her."
The Vice Admiral eyed Morris closely.
"She's yours if you want her. You up to it?"
"My personal gear's still aboard Ferris," Morris temporized. Did he really want to go back out?
"Packed up and on the way down, Ed." There were plenty of men who could do it, Morris thought. The operations staff he'd been working with since he arrived in Norfolk was full of people who'd leap at this. Go back to sea and put it on the line again, or drive back every night to an empty home and nightmares. "If you want me, I'll take her."
Folzehausen, Federal Republic of Germany. The northern horizon flashed with artillery fire that backlit the trees. The sky was never free of the thunder. The drive to the divisional command post was a mere 15 kilometers from Alfeld. 3 vicious air attacks and 20 separate artillery barrages had converted the morning drive into a nightmare lasting into dusk and beyond. The forward headquarters of 20th Tanks was now the command post for the entire drive toward Hameln. Lieutenant General Beregovoy, who had relieved Alexeyev, now wore the hats of Commander 20th Tanks
and Operational Maneuver Group Commander. The OMG concept had been one of the most precious Soviet pre-war ideas. The daring thrust would open a corridor into the enemy's rear, and the Operational Maneuver Group would exploit it, racing into the corridor to seize important economic or political targets. Alexeyev stood with his back against an armored vehicle, looking north at the flashing outline of a forest. Another thing that hasn't gone according to plan, he thought. As if we expected NATO to cooperate with our plans. There was a yellow flash overhead. Alexeyev blinked his eyes clear and watched the fireball turn to a comet that fell to the earth, landing several kilometers away. Ours or theirs, he wondered. Another promising young life snuffed out by a missile. Now we kill our young men with robots. Who said mankind was not using his technology to worthwhile ends? He had prepared his whole life for this. 4 years in officer school. The difficult initiation as a junior officer, promotion to command a company. 3 more years at Frunze Military Academy in Moscow after he'd been recognized as a rising star. Then command of a battalion. Back to Moscow to the Voroshilov Academy of the General Staff. Top man in his class. Command of a regiment, then a division. All for this? A field hospital was in the trees 500 meters away, and the wind carried the shrieks of the wounded to the command post. Not like that in the movies he'd watched as a child, and still watched. The wounded were supposed to suffer in quiet, determined dignity, puffing on cigarettes proffered by the kindly, hard-working medics, waiting their turn for the courageous, hard-working surgeons and the pretty, dedicated nurses. A fucking lie, all of it, a monstrous fucking lie, he told himself. The profession for which he had prepared his life was organized murder. He sent boys with pimples on their faces into a landscape rained on with steel and watered with blood. The burns were the worst. The tank crews who escaped from their brewed-up vehicles with their clothes alight, they never stopped screaming. Those killed by shock or the pistol of a merciful officer were only replaced by more. The lucky ones who reached the casualty clearing stations found medics too busy to offer cigarettes, and doctors who were dropping from fatigue. His brilliant tactical success at Alfeld had led nowhere yet, and he wondered in his soul if it ever would, if he had cast young lives away for nothing more than words in books written by men who did their best to forget the horrors they had inflicted and endured. "Second thoughts now, Pasha?" he asked himself. "And what of those 4 colonels you had shot? Rather late to discover a conscience, isn't it?" But now it wasn't a map-table game or an exercise at Shpola, nor a handful of routine training accidents. It was one thing for a company commander to see all this after following orders from above. It was another for the man who gave the orders to view his handiwork. There is nothing so terrible as a battle won, except a battle lost. Alexeyev remembered the quote from Wellington's commentary on Waterloo, one of the 2 million books in the Frunze Library. Certainly not something written by a Russian general. Why had he ever been allowed to read that? If soldiers read more of those remarks and less of glory, then what would they do when their political masters ordered them to march? "Now there," the general told himself, "there is a radical idea." He urinated against a tree and walked back towards the command post. He found Beregovoy leaning over the map. A good man and an effective soldier, Alexeyev knew. What did he think of all this? "Comrade, that Belgian brigade just reappeared. It's attacking our left flank. They caught 2 regiments moving into new positions. We have a problem here." Alexeyev strode to Beregovoy's side and surveyed the available units. NATO still was not cooperating. The attack had come at the junction of 2 divisions, one worn out, the other fresh but unblooded. A lieutenant moved some counters. The Soviet regiments were pulling back. "Keep the reserve regiment in place," Alexeyev ordered. Have this one move northwest. We'll try to catch the Belgians' flank as they approach this road junction. Professionalism dies hard in the soldier.
Iceland. Well, there it is.
Edwards handed his binoculars to Sergeant Smith. Famsfjordr was still miles away. Their first sight of it came from the top of a 2,000-foot hill. A sparkling river below them fed into the fjord, more than 10 miles away. Everyone kept low, afraid to be skylined with the low sun behind them. Edwards broke out his radio.
Doghouse, this is Beagle. The objective is in sight.
This was a particularly dumb thing to say, Edwards knew. Famsfjordr was almost 30 miles long, about 10 miles across at its widest point. The man in Scotland was impressed. Edwards's party had covered 15 kilometers in the past 10 hours.
What kind of shape are you in?
If you want us to go any farther, fella, this radio might malfunction.
Roger, copy that.
The major tried not to laugh.
Where exactly are you?
About 5 miles east of Hill 578. Now that we're here, maybe you might tell us why, Edwards suggested.
If you see any, repeat any Russian activity, we want to know about it immediately. One guy taking a leak against a rock, we want to know about it. Do you copy that?
Roger, you want the size in inches.
No Ruskies in view yet. Some ruins to our left and a farm a ways downriver from us.
Nothing moving at either place.
Any particular location you want us?
We're working on that.
Sit tight for the moment. Find a nice place to hide and stay put.
What's your food situation?
We have enough fish to last out the day, and I can see a lake where we might get some more.
Remember when you said you'd have some pizza sent out, Doghouse?
Right now I'd kill for one.
Pepperoni and onions.
Fish is good for you.
Beagle, your signal strength is down. You want to start thinking about conserving your batteries.
Anything else to report?
Negative. We'll be back if we see anything.
Out.
Edward slapped his hands down on the power switch.
People, we are home.
That's nice, Skipper, Smith laughed.
Where's home?
Bord Hardalur is other side that mountain, Vigdis offered. My Uncle Helgi lived there.
We could probably get a decent meal there, Edwards told himself. Maybe some lamb, a few beers or something stronger, and a bed. A real soft bed with sheets and the down quilts they use here. A bath, hot water to shave, toothpaste.
Edwards could smell every part of himself. They tried to wash in the streams when they could, but mostly they couldn't.
I smell like a goat, Edwards thought.
Whatever a goat smells like.
But we didn't walk this far to do something as stupid as that.
Sarge, let's secure this place.
You got it, Skipper.
Roger, sack out. Garcia, you and me have the first watch. 4 hours. You take that little knoll over there. I'll head over to the right.
Smith stood and looked down at Edwards.
Good idea that we all get some rest while we can, Skipper.
Sounds great to me.
You see anything important, give me a kick.
Smith nodded and moved about 100 yards.
Rogers was already half asleep, his head resting on his folded jacket. The private's rifle was cradled on his chest.
We stay here? Vigdis asked.
I'd sure like to go see your uncle, but there might be Russians in that town.
How do you feel?
Tired.
Tired as us? He asked with a grin.
Yes, tired as you, she admitted.
Vigdis lay back next to Edwards. She was filthy. Her woolen sweater was torn in several places, and her boots scuffed beyond repair.
What will happen to us now?
I don't know. They wanted us here for a reason, though.
But they don't tell you reason, she objected.
Now there's an intelligent observation, Edwards thought.
They tell you, and you not tell us? Vigdis asked. No, you know as much as I do.
Michael, why all this happen?
Why do the Russians come here?
I don't know. But you are officer, you must know.
Vigdis propped herself up on her elbows. She seemed genuinely astonished. Edward smiled. He couldn't blame her for being confused. Iceland's only armed force was its police. A real-to-life, peaceable kingdom, the country had no military to speak of. A few small armed ships for fishery protection and the police were all the country had ever needed to maintain security. This war had ruined their perfect record. For 1,000 years, without an army or a navy, Iceland had never been attacked. It had only happened now because they were in the way. He wondered if that would have happened if NATO hadn't built its base at Keflavik. Of course not. You idiot, you've seen what wonderful folks the Russians are. NATO base or not, Iceland was in their way. But why the hell had all this happened?
Vigdis, I'm a meteorologist. A weatherman. I predict the weather for the Air Force.
That only made her more confused.
Not soldier? Not a marine soldier?
Mike shook his head.
I'm an officer in the U.S. Air Force, yes, but I am not really a soldier like the sergeant. I have a different job.
But you saved my life. You are a soldier.
Yeah, I suppose I am. By accident.
When this all over, what will you do?
Her eyes held a great deal of interest now.
One thing at a time.
He was thinking in terms of hours, not days or weeks.
If we do survive, then what?
Put that one aside. First comes survival. You think about after the war, and there won't be any.
I'm too tired to think about that. Let's get some sleep.
She fought it. He knew that she wanted to know things he hadn't consciously considered, but she was more fatigued than she'd admitted, and 10 minutes later she was asleep. She snored. Mike hadn't noticed before. This was no China doll. She had strengths and weaknesses, good points and bad. She had the face of an angel, but she'd gotten herself pregnant.
So what? Edwards thought.
She's braver than she's beautiful. She saved my life when that chopper came in on us. A man could do far worse. Edwards commanded himself to lie down and sleep. He couldn't think about this. First, he had to survive.
Scotland.
If the area checks out? The major asked.
He had never really expected Edwards and his party to make it this far, not with 8,000 Russian troops on the island. Every time he thought about those 5 people trekking over bare rocky ground and Soviet helicopters circling overhead, his skin crawled.
Around midnight, I think, the man from Special Operations Executive said.
You could see the smile crinkling the skin around his eye patch.
You chaps had better decorate this young man. I've been in his boots myself. You cannot imagine how difficult it is to do what these people have done, and having a bloody hind helicopter sit right on top of them. I've always said it's the quiet little bastards that you have to watch out for.
In any case, it's time we got some professionals in to back them up, pronounced the captain of Royal Marines.
Make sure they take in some food, suggested the USAF major.
Langley Air Force Base, Virginia.
So, what's the problem? Nakamura asked.
There are irregularities in some of the rocket motor casings, the engineer explained.
Irregularities meaning they go boom?
Possibly, the engineer admitted.
Super, said Major Nakamura. I'm supposed to carry that monster 17 miles straight the hell up and then find out who goes into orbit, me or it.
When this sort of rocket explodes, it doesn't do much. It just breaks into a couple of pieces that burn out by themselves.
I imagine from 17 miles off it doesn't look like much. What about when the sucker ignites 20 feet from my F-15?
A long way to skydive, Buns thought.
I'm sorry, Major. This rocket motor is nearly 10 years old. Nobody checked our spec sheet on proper storage after it was mated with the ASAT warhead. We've checked it out with X-rays and ultrasound. I think it's okay, but I might be wrong, the man from Lockheed said. Of the 6 remaining ASAT missiles, 3 had been decertified by the man for cracks in the solid fuel propellant. The other 3 were question marks. You want the truth, or you want a song and dance? You gotta fly it, Major, the deputy commander of Tactical Air Command said. It's your decision. Can we rig it so the bird doesn't ignite until I'm clear? How long will you need? The engineer asked. Buns thought about her speed and maneuverability at that altitude. Say 10 or 15 seconds. I'll have to make a small change in the programming software, but that shouldn't be much of a problem. We'll have to make sure that the missile will retain enough forward velocity to keep its launch attitude, though. You sure that's enough time? No. We'll have to check that out on the simulator, too. How long we got? Minimum 2 days, maximum 6 days. Depends on the Navy, replied the general. Great. Stornoway, Scotland. Here's some good news, Toland announced. An Air Force F-15 Eagle fighter was flying over a fast convoy north of the Azores. 2 bears came looking for the ships, and the Eagle got them both. That makes 3 in the past 4 days. The backfire raid appears to have aborted. What's their position? The group captain asked. Toland ran his hand along the chart, checking latitude and longitude against the numbers on the dispatch form. Looks like right about here. And that datum is 20 minutes old. That puts them over Iceland in just under 2 hours. What about tankers? The Navy fighter commander asked. Not on such short notice. We can stretch that far with 2 fighters, using another 2 for buddy stores, but it only gives them about 20 minutes on station, under 5 on burner, and a 10-minute reserve when they get back here. The fighter boss whistled. Close. Too close. We have to wave off on this. A phone rang. The British base commander grabbed. Group Captain Mallory? Yes. Very well, scramble. He hung up. Klaxons went off at the ready shack half a mile away. Fighter pilots raced to their aircraft. Ivan settled the argument in any case, Commander. Your radar aircraft report heavy jamming activity inbound from the north. The commander raced out the door and jumped into a jeep. Norfolk, Virginia. The drive from SAC-LANT headquarters took 10 minutes. The Marines at the main gate were checking everyone and everything carefully, even a Chevy with a 3-star flag. They drove to the waterfront amid an unending flurry of activity. Trains rolled down the tracks set in the streets. Repair shops and testing facilities worked around the clock. Even the McDonald's on the road immediately outside was working a 24-hour day, feeding hamburgers and fries to the men who took a few minutes for nourishment. For sailors, spending a day or so on land, it was an important, if seemingly trivial, touchstone. The car turned right as it reached the docks, past the submarine piers, to the ones that held destroyers.
She's brand new, only a month in commission, just about long enough to calibrate the electronics, and they must have shaved some time on that, the admiral said. Captain Wilkins did continuous workups on the transit from San Diego, but nothing with helicopters yet. Pack Fleet kept hers, and I can't give you a regular helo compliment either. All we have left is 1 Seahawk F variant, a prototype helo they were evaluating down at Jacksonville.
The one with the dipping sonar? Ed Morris asked.
I can live with that. How about a driver who knows how to use it? It's covered. Lieutenant Commander O'Malley. We pulled him out of a training billet at Jack's. I've heard the name. He was doing systems qualifications on Mosbrugger when I was tactical action officer on John Rogers. Yeah, he knows the job. Have to drop you off here. I'll be back in an hour after I have a look at what's left of the kid.
Reuben James, a raked clipper bow marked with hull number 57, hung over the dock like a guillotine blade. His weariness momentarily forgotten, Morris stepped out of the Chevy to examine his new command with all the quiet enthusiasm of a man with his newborn child. He'd seen FFG-7-class frigates, but never been aboard one. Her severe hull lines reminded him of a cigarette racing yacht. 6 5-inch mooring lines secured her to the pier, but the sleek form already seemed to be straining at them. At only 3,900 tons full load, not a large ship, but manifestly a fast one to go in harm's way. Her superstructure was an aesthetic embarrassment, with all the grace of a brick garage, topped with antenna whips and radar masts that looked like they had been built by a child's erector set. But Morris saw the functional simplicity of the design. The frigate's 40 missiles were tucked away in circular racks forward. Her boxy after-deck house contained enough room for a pair of deadly ASW helicopters. Her hull was sleek because speed required it. Her superstructure was boxy because it had to be. This was a warship, and whatever beauty Reuben James might have had was accidental. Sailors wearing blue shirts and jeans moved rapidly across 3 gangways, bringing supplies aboard for an immediate sailing. Morris walked briskly to the after gangway. A marine guard saluted him at the foot of the brow, and an officer on the frigate's deck frantically ordered preparations to receive his new CO. The ship's bell was struck 4 times, and Commander Ed Morris assumed his new identity. Reuben James arriving. Morris saluted the colors, then the officer of the deck. "Sir, we didn't expect you for another," the lieutenant blurted. "How's the work going?" Morris cut him off. 2 more hours top, sir." "Fine." Morris smiled. "We can worry about the Mickey Mouse later. Get back to work, Mr.
Lyle, sir, ship control officer."
"And what the hell is that?" Morris wondered.
"Okay, Mr. Lyles. Where's the XO?"
"Right here, skipper."
The executive officer had grease on his shirt and a smudge on his cheek.
"I was in the generator room. Pardon the way I look."
"What kind of shape are we in?"
"It'll do. Full load of fuel and weapons. The tail's fully calibrated."
"How'd you do that so fast?"
"It wasn't easy, sir, but we got it done."
"How's Captain Wilkins?"
"The docs say he'll be all right, but, well, he's out of the business for a while."
"I'm Ed Morris."
Captain and executive officer shook hands.
"Frank Ernst, first time I've operated in the Atlantic Fleet."
The lieutenant commander smiled crookedly.
"Picked a great time for it. Anyway, we're in good shape, skipper. Everything works. Our helo pilot's up in the combat information center with the tactical guys. We got Jerry the Hammer. I played ball with him at Annapolis. He's good people. We got 3 real good chiefs. One's a qualified officer of the deck. The crew's on the young side, but I'd say we're about as ready as you could ask. Ready to sail in 2-3 hours tops.
Where's your personal gear, sir?"
"It ought to be here in half an hour."
"What's the problem below?"
"No sweat. An oil line let go on number 3 diesel generator. Yard goof wasn't welded right. It's fixed. You'll love the engine room, skipper. On builder's trials in 5-foot seas, we topped out at 31.5 knots.
Ernst raised his eyebrows.
"Fast enough?"
"And the stabilizers?" Morris asked.
"They work just fine, skipper."
"What about the ASW troops?"
"Let's meet 'em."
Morris followed his XO into the superstructure. They proceeded forward between the 2 helicopter hangars, then to the left, past officers' country, and up a ladder. The combat information center was located 1 level below and just aft of the bridge, adjoining the commanding officer's stateroom. Dark as a cave, it was newer than Ferris's and larger, but no less crammed. 20 or more people were at work running a simulation.
"No, goddammit!" howled a loud voice. "You have to react faster! This here's a victor, and he ain't gonna wait for you to make up your damn mind."
"Attention on deck. Captain in combat," called Ernst.
"As you were," called Morris. "Who's that loud son of a bitch?" A barrel-chested man emerged from the shadows. His eyes were surrounded by crinkles from looking into too many low suns. So this was Jerry the Hammer O'Malley. He knew him only by a crackling voice on a UHF radio, and by his reputation as a sub-hunter who cared more for his trade than promotion boards.
"I guess you mean me, Captain. O'Malley, I'm supposed to drive your Seahawk Foxtrot."
"You're right about the Victor. One of those bastards blew my first chip near in half."
"Sorry to hear that, but you ought to know that Ivan's putting his best skippers in the Victors. She handles better than anything else they got, and that rewards a smart driver. So you were up against the Varsity. Did you have him outside?"
Morris shook his head. "We were late picking him up. Just coming off a sprint, and acoustical conditions weren't all that great. But we detected him. He couldn't have been more than 5 miles out. We had the helo after him, just about had him localized. Then he broke contact, neat as you please, and got inside on us."
"Yeah, the Victor's good at that. Pump fake, I call it. He starts going one way, then turns hard the other, leaves a knuckle in the water, and probably a noisemaker, too, right in the middle of it. Then he dives down under the layer and makes a quick sprint in. They've been refining that tactic for the past few years, and we've had trouble programming a reliable counter for it. You need a sharp crew in the helo, and you need good teamwork with these guys here."
"Unless you read my report, my friend, you must be a mind reader."
"Right, Captain, but all the minds I read think in Russian. The pump fake's what the Victor is best at, and you have to pay attention, what with his ability to accelerate and turn so quick. What I've been trying to teach people is when he shows turn to port, you start thinking he's really going to starboard, and you slide over maybe 2,000 yards and wait a minute or two, then you hammer the bastard hard and pickle off the fish before he can react."
"And if you're wrong?"
"Then you're wrong, Skipper. Mostly, though, Ivan's predictable, if you think like a submariner and you look at his tactical situation instead of your own. You can't keep him from running away, but his mission is to close on the target, and you can make life real hard for him if he does."
Morris looked O'Malley hard in the eyes. He didn't like having the loss of his first command analyzed so glibly. But there was no time for these thoughts. O'Malley was a pro, and if there was a man to handle another Victor, this might be the one. "You all ready?"
"The bird is at the air station. We'll join up after you clear the capes. I wanted to talk things over with the ASW team while we had the time."
"We're going to play outside ASW picket?"
"Probably. With a towed array, it doesn't figure that we're going to be in close. And we might be teamed with a Brit for the convoy mission."
"Fair enough. If you want my opinion, we have a pretty solid ASW team here. We might just give the bad guys a hard time. Weren't you on Rogers a few years back?"
"When you were working with the Moose. We worked together twice, but never met. I was X-ray Mike when we exercised against Skake."
"I thought I remembered you." O'Malley came closer and dropped his voice.
"How bad is it out there?"
"Bad enough. We lost the GIUK line. We're getting some pretty good Certas info, but you can bet Ivan's going to be gunning for those tuna boats pretty soon. Between the air threat and the sub-threat, I don't know." His face showed more than his voice did. Close friends dead or missing. His own first command blown in half. Morris was tired in a way that sleep alone would not cure. O'Malley nodded.
"Skipper, we got us a shiny new frigate, a great new helo and a tail. We can hold our end up."
"Well, we'll have a shot soon enough. We sail for New York in 2 hours and take a convoy out on Wednesday."
"Alone?" O'Malley asked.
"No, we'll have Brit company for the New York run, HMS Battleaxe. The orders haven't been confirmed yet, but it looks like we'll be working together all the way across."
"That'll be useful," Ernst agreed. "Come on aft, Skipper. I'll show you what we're up to."
The sonar room was aft of CIC, closed off by a curtain. Here, real lighting was on, as opposed to the darkened, red-light world of combat.
"Geez, nobody ever tells me anything," growled a young lieutenant commander.
"Good morning, Captain. I'm Lenner, combat systems officer."
"How come you're not at your scope?"
"We froze the game, Skipper, and I wanted to check out the display on playback."
"I brought the game tape myself," O'Malley explained. "This is the track of a Victor III that faked out one of our carriers in the Eastern Med last year. See here? That's the pump fake. You'll notice that the contact fades out, then brightens up. That's the noisemaker inside the knuckle. At this point, he ducked under the layer and sprinted inside the screen. Would have hit the carrier, too, because they didn't get him for another 10 minutes. That—he jammed his finger at the display—is what you look for. This tells you you're up against a driver who knows his stuff, and he's out for your ass."
Morris examined the screen closely enough to recognize the pattern. He'd seen it once before.
"What if they use the maneuver to break clear?" Lenner asked.
"Because if they can break contact, why not break contact towards the target?" Morris asked quietly, noting that he had a very young combat systems officer.
"That's right, Skipper." O'Malley nodded ruefully. "Like I said, this is a standard tactic for them, and it rewards a sharp driver. The aggressive ones will always bore in. The ones who break off, that's effectively a kill. We have to reacquire, but so do they. With a 20-knot speed of advance, once we get past them, they have to play catch-up. That means making noise. The guy who runs away probably won't run the risk, or if he does, he'll do it badly, and we'll get him. No, this tactic is for the guy who really wants to get in close. Question is, how many of their skippers are that aggressive?"
"Enough." Morris looked away for a moment.
"How's the helicopter complement?"
"Only one flight crew for the bird. My co-pilot's pretty green, but our onboard systems operator's a first-class petty officer who's been around the block a few times. The maintenance guys are a pickup bunch, mostly from the readiness group at Jack's. I've talked to them. They should do just fine."
"We got berths for them all?" Morris asked.
Ernst shook his head.
"Not hardly. We're packed pretty tight."
"O'Malley, is your co-pilot deck qualified?"
"Not on a frigate. I am. Hell, I did some of the first systems trials back in 78. We'll have to do workups on the way to New York both day and night to get my ensign in the groove. Scratch team, Skipper. The bird doesn't even belong to an operational squadron."
"You sounded confident a minute ago," Morris objected.
"I am fairly confident," O'Malley said. "My people know how to use the tools they got. They're sharp kids. They'll learn fast. And we even get to make up our own call signs."
A wide grin. Certain things are important to aviators. There was one other unspoken message. When O'Malley referred to the aviation department as "my people," he meant that he didn't want any interference in how he ran his shop. Morris ignored it. He didn't want an argument. Not now.
"Okay, XO, let's look around. O'Malley, I expect we'll rendezvous off the Capes."
"The Hilo's ready to launch right now, Captain. We'll be there when you want us."
Morris nodded and went forward. The captain's personal ladder to the bridge was a bare 3 feet from the CIC floor, and his own. He trotted up. Or tried to. His legs rubbery with exhaustion.
"Captain on the bridge," a petty officer announced.
Morris was not impressed. He was appalled to see that the ship's wheel was only a brass dial about the size of a telephone's. The helmsman actually had a seat, offset from the center line, and to his right was a clear plastic box containing the direct control throttle to the ship's jet turbine engines. A metal rod suspended from the overhead ran completely from one side of the pilot house to the other, at a height that allowed it to be grabbed easily in heavy seas. An eloquent comment on this ship's stability.
"Have you served on a FIG before, sir?" the XO asked.
"Never been aboard one," Morris answered.
The heads of the four men on bridge watch each turned a hair at that.
"I know the weapons systems,"
I was part of the design team at NAVSEA back a few years ago, and I know more or less how she handles.
She handles her like a sports car, Ernst assured him. You'll especially like the way we can turn the engines off, drift as quiet as a log, then be up to 30 knots in 2 minutes flat.
How quickly can we get underway?
10 minutes from your say-so, Captain. The engine lube oil is already warmed up. There's a harbor tug standing by to assist us away from the dock.
Nav Surflant arriving, boomed the announcing system.
2 minutes later, the Admiral appeared in the pilot house.
I have a man bringing your gear up. What do you think?
XO, will you see to the provisioning? Morris said to Ernst. Then,
shall we discover my stateroom together, Admiral?
A steward was waiting for them below with a tray of coffee and sandwiches. Morris poured himself a cup, another for the Admiral, and ignored the food.
Sir, I've never handled one of these before. I don't know the engines.
You've got a great chief engineer, and she's a dream to handle. Besides, you have your conning officers. You're a weapons and tactics man, Ed. All your work is done in CIC. We need you out there.
Fair enough, sir.
XO, take her out, Morris ordered 2 hours later. He watched Ernst's every move, embarrassed that he had to depend on another to do it. But it was amazingly easy. The wind was off the pier, and the frigate had a huge sail area that invited help. As the mooring lines were slackened off, the wind and the auxiliary power units located on the hull directly under the bridge pushed James's bow into the clear. Then the gas turbine engines moved her forward into the channel. Ernst took his time, though he was clearly capable of doing it faster. Morris took careful note of this, too. The man didn't want to make his captain look bad. From there on it was easy, and Ed Morris watched his new crew at work. He'd heard stories about the California Navy. Like, okay, man. But the quartermasters at the chart table updated the position with crisp assurance, despite the unfamiliar harbor. They glided noiselessly past the piers of the Navy Yard. He saw empty berths that would not soon be filled, and not a few ships whose sleek gray hulls were marred with scorched holes and twisted steel. Kid was there, her forward superstructure wrecked by a Russian missile that had gotten past her multi-layered defenses. One of his sailors was looking that way, too, a boy still in his teens, puffing on a cigarette which he flicked over the side. Morris wanted to ask what he was thinking, but could scarcely describe his own thoughts. It went quickly after that. They turned east at the empty carrier berthings, over the Hampton Bridge Tunnel, then past the crowded amphibious basin at Little Creek. Now the sea beckoned them, forbiddingly gray under the cloudy sky. HMS Battle Axe was already out there, 3 miles ahead, a subtly different shade on her hull, and the white ensign fluttering at her mast. A signal light started blinking at them.
"What the devil is a Reuben James?" Battleaxe wanted to know.
"How do you want to answer that, sir?" a signalman asked. Morris laughed, the ominous spell broken.
"Signal. At least we don't name warships for our mother-in-law."
"All right."
The petty officer loved it.
Stornoway, Scotland.
"The blinder isn't supposed to be able to carry missiles," Tolan said. But what he saw gave the lie to that intelligence assessment. 6 missiles had gotten through the defending fighters and landed inside the perimeter of the RAF base. 2 aircraft were burning half a mile away, and one of the base's radars was wrecked.
"Well, now we know why their activity has been light the past few days. They were refitting their bombers to deal with our new fighter force," Group Captain Mallory said, surveying the damage to his base. "Action, reaction. We learn, they learn."
The fighters were returning. Toland counted them off in his head. He came up short by 2 Tornadoes and 1 Tomcat. As soon as the landing rolls were completed, each fighter taxied to its shelter.
The RAF did not have enough permanent ones. Three of the American fighters ended up in sandbag revetments, where ground crews immediately refueled and rearmed their aircraft. The crews climbed down their ladders to waiting jeeps and were driven off for debriefing.
"Bastards used our own trick on us," one Tomcat pilot exclaimed.
"Okay, what did you run into?"
"There were two groups about 10 miles apart. Lead group was MiG-23 floggers with the blinders behind them. The MiGs launched before we did. They really knocked our radars back with white noise, and some of their fighters were using something brand new, a deceptive jammer we haven't run across yet. They must have been at the edge of their fuel, 'cause they didn't try to mix it up with us. I guess they just wanted to keep us off the bombers until they launched. Damn near worked. A flight of tornadoes came around them on the left and bagged four of the blinders, I think. We got a pair of MiGs, no blinders, and the boss vectored the rest of the Toms onto the missiles. I splashed two. Anyway, Ivan's changed tactics on us. We lost one Tomcat. I don't know what got him."
"Next time," another pilot said.
"We go up with some of our missiles preset to go after the jammers. We didn't have enough time to set that up. If we can get the jammers first, it'll be easier to handle the fighters."
"And then the Russians will change their tactics again," Tolan thought. "Well, at least we have them reacting to us for a change." Faltzhausen, Federal Republic of Germany. After 8 hours of vicious fighting that saw artillery fire dropping on the forward command post, Beregovoy and Alexeyev stopped the Belgian counterattack. But stopping them wasn't enough. They'd advanced 6 kilometers before running into a solid wall of tanks and missiles, and the Belgian artillery was laying heavy intermittent fire on the main road supporting the Russian advance toward Hameln. Certainly they were preparing for another attack, Alexeyev thought. We have to hit them first. But with what? He needed his 3 divisions to advance on the British formations standing before Hameln.
"Every time we break through," Major Sergeyev observed quietly, "they slow us down and counterattack. This was not supposed to happen."
"A splendid observation," Alexeyev snarled,
then regained his temper.
"We expected that a breakthrough would have the same effect as in the last war against the Germans. The problem is these new light anti-tank missiles. 3 men and a jeep," he even used the American title for it, "can race along the road, set up, fire 1 or 2 missiles, be gone before we can react, then repeat the process a few 100 meters away. Defensive firepower was never so strong before, and we failed to appreciate how effectively a handful of rear-guard troops can slow down an advancing column. Our security is based on movement." Alexeyev explained the basic lesson from tank school. "A mobile force under these conditions cannot afford to be slowed down. A simple breakthrough is not enough. We must blast a massive hole in their front and race at least 20 kilometers to be free of these roving missile crews. Only then can we switch over to true mobile doctrine."
"You say we cannot win?"
Sergeyev had begun to have his own doubts, but did not expect to hear them from his commander.
"I say what I did 4 months ago, and I was correct. This campaign of ours has become a war of attrition. For the moment, technology has defeated the military art, ours and theirs. What we're doing now is seeing who runs out of men and arms first."
"We have more of both," Sergeyev said.
"That is true, Ivan Mikhailovich. I have many more young men to throw away." More casualties were arriving at the field hospital. The line of trucks running in and out never stopped.
"Comrade General, I received a message from my father. He wishes to know how things progress at the front. What should I tell him?"
Alexeyev walked away from his aide for a minute to ponder that.
"Ivan Mikhailovich, tell the minister that NATO opposition is far more serious than we expected. The key now is supplies. We need the best information we can get on NATO's supply situation, and a determined effort to worsen that situation. We have received little information on how well the naval operations to kill NATO convoys are going. I need that in order to evaluate NATO's endurance. I don't want analyses out of Moscow. I want the raw data."
You are unhappy with what we get from Moscow?
We were told that NATO was politically divided and militarily uncoordinated. How would you evaluate that report, Comrade Major? Alexeyev asked sharply. I can't go through military channels with that sort of request, can I?
Write up your travel orders.
I want you back here in 36 hours.
I'm sure we'll still be here.
Iceland.
They should be there in half an hour.
Roger that, doghouse, Edwards replied. Like I said, no Russians visible. We haven't seen any aircraft all day. There was some movement on the road west of us 6 hours ago. 4 Jeep-type vehicles. Too far off to tell what was in them, and they were southbound. The coast is clear. Over.
Okay, let us know when they get there.
Will do. Out.
Edwards killed the radio.
People, we got some friends coming in.
Who and when, Skipper? Smith asked at once.
Didn't say, but they'll be here in half an hour.
Must be an airdrop.
They come take us out? Vigdis asked.
No, they can't land a plane here. Sarge, you got any opinions?
Same as yours, I expect.
The plane was early, and for once Edwards saw it first. The C-130 Hercules four-engine transport skimmed down from the northwest, only a few hundred feet over the eastern slope of the ridge they were on. A stiff breeze blew from the west as 4 small shapes emerged from the aft cargo door, and the Hercules turned abruptly north to leave the area. Edwards concentrated on the descending parachutes. Instead of drifting down into the valley below them, the parachutists were coming straight down to a rock-filled slope.
Oh, shit, he misjudged the wind. Come on!
The parachutes dropped below them as they ran downhill. One by one they stopped, losing their shape in the semi-darkness as the men landed. Edwards and his party moved rapidly, trying to remember where the men had landed. Their camouflage chutes turned invisible as soon as they touched the ground.
Halt! Okay, okay, we're here to meet you, Edwards said.
Identify yourself!
The voice had an English accent.
Codename Beagle.
Proper name?
Edwards, First Lieutenant, U.S. Air Force.
Approach slowly, mate.
Mike went forward alone. At length he saw a vague shape, half hidden by a rock. The shape held a submachine gun.
Who are you?
Sergeant Nichols, Royal Marines.
You picked a bloody poor place to receive us, Lieutenant.
I didn't do it, Edwards answered. We didn't know you were coming until an hour ago.
Balls up, another bloody balls up.
The man stood and walked forward with a pronounced limp.
Parachuting's dangerous enough without coming into a fucking rock garden.
Another figure came up.
We found the lieutenant. I think he's dead.
Need help? Mike asked.
I need to wake up and find myself home in bed.
Edward soon found that the party sent to rescue him, or whatever their mission was, had gotten off to a disastrous start. The lieutenant in command of the group had landed on one boulder and fallen backward on another. His head hung from the rest of his body as if on a string. Nichols had sprained his ankle badly, and the other two were uninjured but shaken. It took over an hour to locate all their gear. There was no time for sentiment. The lieutenant was wrapped in his parachute and covered with loose rocks. Edwards led the rest back to his perch on the hilltop. At least they'd brought a new battery pack for his radio.
Doghouse, this is Beagle, and things suck. Over.
What took so long?
Tell that Herky-Bird driver to get a new eye doctor. The Marines you sent here got their boss killed, and their sergeant ripped his ankle up.
Have you been spotted?
Negative. They landed in rocks. It's a miracle they weren't all killed.
We're back on the hilltop. We covered our tracks.
Sergeant Nichols was a smoker. He and Smith found a sheltered spot to light up.
Sounds rather excitable, your lieutenant.
He's only a wing wiper, but he's doing all right.
How's the ankle?
I'll have to walk on it whether it's fit or not.
Does he know what he's about?
The skipper?
I watched him kill 3 Russians with a knife. That good enough?
Bloody hell.
Chapter 33 Contact. USS Reuben James.
Captain?
Morris started at the hand on his shoulder. He'd just wanted to lie down in his stateroom for a few minutes after conducting helicopter night landing practice and... He checked his watch. After midnight. His face was sweaty. The dream had just started again. He looked up at his executive officer.
What is it, XL?
We got a request to check something out. Probably a snowbird, but... Well, see for yourself. Morris took the dispatch with him to his private bathroom, tucked it in his pocket, then washed his face quickly. Unusual contact repeated several times. Have attempted localization without success? What the hell is this supposed to be? He asked, toweling off.
Beats the hell out of me, Skipper.
40 degrees, 30 minutes north, 69, 50 west. They got a location, but no ID. I'm having the chart pulled now. Morris ran his hand through his hair. 2 hours sleep was better than none, wasn't it? Okay, let's see how it looks from CIC. The tactical action officer had the chart out on the table next to the captain's chair. Morris checked the main tactical display scope. They were still far offshore in accordance with their orders to check out the 100-fathom curve.
That's way the hell away from here, Morris observed immediately.
There was something familiar about the location. The captain bent over the chart.
Yes, sir. About a 60-mile run, Ernst agreed. Shallow water, too. Can't use the towed array there.
Oh, I know what this place is. That's where the Andrea Doria sank. Probably somebody's got a mad contact and didn't bother checking his chart.
Don't think so.
O'Malley emerged from the shadows.
A frigate heard something first. The winch on their tail was busted. They didn't want to lose it, so they were heading into Newport instead of New York because the harbor's deeper.
They say they copied a strange passive sonar contact that faded out. They did a target motion analysis and generated this position. Their helicopter made a few passes, and its magnetic anomaly detector registered right over the Doria, and that was that.
How'd you find that out?
O'Malley handed over a message form.
Came in right after the XO went to get you. They sent an Orion to check it. Same story. They heard something odd, and it faded out.
Morris frowned. They were chasing after a wild goose, but the orders came from Norfolk. That made it an official wild goose chase.
What's the helo status?
I can be up in 10 minutes. One torpedo and an auxiliary fuel tank. All the gear's online. Tell the bridge to take us there at 25 knots.
Battleaxe know about this?
He got a nod. Okay, signal them what we're up to. Winch in the tail. Won't do us any good where we're going. O'Malley, we'll close to within 15 miles of the contact and have you search for it. That puts you in the air about 0230. If you need me, I'll be in the wardroom. Morris decided to sample his new ship's midrats. O'Malley was headed the same way.
These ships are a little weird, the flyer said.
Morris grunted agreement. The main fore and aft passageway was on the port side instead of the center line, for one thing. The figs broke a number of long-standing traditions in ship design. O'Malley went down the ladder first and opened the wardroom door for the captain. They found 2 junior officers in front of the TV set, watching a taped movie that had mainly to do with fast cars and naked women. The tape machine, Morris had already learned, was run from the chief's quarters. One result of this was that a particularly attractive chest was instant replayed for all hands. Mid-watch rations, or midrats, was an open loaf of bread and a plate of cold cuts. Morris got himself a cup of coffee and built a sandwich. O'Malley opted for a fruit drink from the cooler on the after bulkhead. The official Navy term for it was bug juice.
Coffee? Morris asked.
O'Malley shook his head.
Too much makes me jumpy. You don't want shaky hands when you're landing a helo in the dark.
He smiled.
I really am getting too old for this crap.
Kids?
3 boys, and ain't none of 'em going to be a sailor if I have anything to say about it.
You? boy and a girl. They are back in Kansas with their mother. Morris went after his sandwich. The bread was a little stale, and the cold cuts weren't cold, but he needed to eat. This was the first meal in 3 days.